You were talking about the other three quarters of the world and about the way they make music. Is there anything in the way you are making music that is influenced by that?
I would say it's funny. I have I worked at the UN for about 6 years, you know, and I met an incredible amount of people that I used to really spend a lot of time with. Africans, I mean, just one time I was spending some time, they were, my chief was a Japanese one time, and music is very, very vital, you know, you listen to music. And I must have listened. They had UNESCO has produced a series of records which are really incredible, the UNESCO series. And one time, I had that entire series. I still do someplace in New York. I think they were my things in storage. I remember once doing a piece of music. I did a score for a piece of music for Sodder's No Exit. I remember a person saying to me that the music sounded like Tibetan music. I have never consciously, when I say consciously, some musicians study a music consciously to extract some things that are interesting to them. I have never consciously engaged myself in it for that way, but I've had people say things. I spent about once, from 1962, I had a thing where I couldn't play, 1962 to 63, and I could only study. And there was some African music and Indian music I listened to during that period, every day. At that time in my life, music went on in my house 24 hours a day, even when I went to bed. And I heard things that I liked, and I once made an attempt to notate an African rhythm, to make a piece on it, and it was a complete bomb. It was the most, it was devastating to me. I mean, it sounded so wrong. But I would say that, well, when I was in 1962, I heard the Peking Opera in Helsinki, Finland. Now, everyone had flipped over about it. I couldn't hear it. I can't. The things were so, they didn't sound right to me. And I couldn't place myself in that situation. Although now I play a lot of quarter tones and things on the instrument. I would say that I have been influenced by everything, and I guess it's by accident if I show any of it. Because the things that I've really been interested in, I think I've actually paid attention to them. But I don't think anyone, like say, I don't think anyone can write any more what I would call amorphous and vacuous music. I don't think you can write for an orchestra you don't know. I don't think you can write for a string quartet you don't know. I think you write for people, if you're writing. When I say writing, doing music for and with the people, because everything is, you can see, I don't believe in writing that way. If you can tell a person, listen, from the sound that you're doing, like, I want you to work in this layer here, just, you know, this is happening here, and find something to do in here. That's writing to me now, like that. All of those systems. But I think in the world's music, in certain areas of the world's music, for me, they're much too strict in the role they relegate for musicians. For example, drummers do this, horn players do this. Although I have sort of fantasized and said, like, for every society that has the overt musical display, there must be people in the society like I am in this one who function in another way without the endorsement of the society. So I would say in Africa where you have master drummers doing certain things and they have to do them based on the cult and sect that they're in, I'm sure some of those guys are working on other things. I'm positive. I can't prove it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, I would say, what I was saying before, though, about three-quarters of the Earth's population, three-quarters of the Earth's population doesn't deal with notational music or formal music as a concept the way we do. They don't deal with music as an aesthetic we do. We have airport music, we have this kind of music, we have that kind of music, you know. Their things are they have music for rights and things like that, but there's no frivolity attached to their music. Music at the airport is to keep you from being nervous if you're getting ready to fly. You just can't stand all that silence. You go into a 60-story building, a little music is piped in like that. That's so that you don't realize that you're going X amount of feet and going way, way up, you know. You go into certain Johns now. I don't know why they have music in the John. You go into certain, you know, like say in certain places now, pipe in public Johns, there'll be music. What the fuck is going on, you know? If they had a little more light, you could read, you know. You know? But, I don't think, what I meant was, I think other areas of the world are less rigid about music. We're very rigid. There's art music, and then there's music for utilitarian purposes, which is our commercial music. And the other areas of the world, they're not that concerned with that. Not the native roles. Those that have been westernized do exactly what we do. You know, I'll give you a good example of something. 1958, I was in Geneva, Switzerland, and something people don't realize. I worked for the first atomic and peaceful uses, second peaceful uses of atomic energy conference. That's right. Mm-hmm. I drew atomic energy symbols. One night, I stayed with a family in a little chalet, and one night, walking through the street, I had dinner with some friends, and I wanted to walk home. Geneva is beautiful, man. I really love that damn place, man. A friend of mine is living there now. And walking through the street, there was a beggar, a blind man. I heard this music on accordion, you know. And there were Charlie Parker lines, you know. Now's the time, Little Willie Leaps, Billy's Bounce, and you know, naturally I hurried and got there, and there was this blind man with a cup playing on the accordion, playing those kinds of tunes. Now, I was shook up. What the hell is this place here? They said, the Swiss are really into things, you know, because now you would never find a blind man here or a beggar playing those pieces of music. He would be playing Sweet Mother Magritte, what are those things, those tear jerkers and things. This man was playing music. That music was in the air. That was music he had heard someplace. See? It was a completely different stance about the music. And he wasn't doing it to be hip because there was no one around. He was doing it.
And he couldn't read it.
And he couldn't read it. You know?
I get the feeling that there's a lot more music going on than, you know, we know about in this country.
A hell of a lot, man. Because like what we do, we're very in this way. I see no difference between us and what they say goes on in the Soviet Union. If what you're doing isn't palatable to people, it's not subsidized and it's suppressed. And it's kept away from people. The interesting thing about the college and the university, and this is the only reason I was really that interested in having black music as a part of the learning thing of young people. 1958, I've been talking about this as an idea since 1957. I said eventually, the way the commercial moguls and entrepreneurs parceling out this music. The only way the art is going to be saved is by it becoming a part of the university, a part of what a course of study, like say philosophers. What can a philosopher do? A philosopher can either teach, or like you have some very hip ones now working on Madison Avenue. Like they'll tell you what they think, people. You know, so he's part of the university system. It's not his fault. He decides to be a philosopher. What the hell? So he's useless to society except as a teacher. Well, when I say useless, I don't mean useless. I mean that this guy's thrust, what he can do, is not one that we can see overtly. We know when something happens. We don't know what's triggered that thing. Well, same thing with art and music. Now, American dance. That's the only way American modern dance has been able to function. The university has subsidized it. That's where it was born, and based on economics in this country, that's where it's going to have to stay. So you make dance departments. That's what Bennington had it is. First thing they had to got them off the ground, really. You take white music, white what you call serious music, is a university subsidized and supported music. Because no musicians have the resources. They don't. Electronic music is within the domain, although now commercial music is using it, the domain of the university. They're the only ones that can house these synthesizers and have this place for the research, the computers, and all that kind of stuff. So then you sit back one day, I remember one day in 1957, I said, because we used to do lectures at colleges and stuff, kids would be, you know, but that was much too exotic, you know what I mean? One lecture and one thing like that, then you're gone. What does that mean? And drink a little beer afterwards, what the fuck is that? I mean, if that's what you did with everything, it would be great. Why should we be singled out for the fun, you know? And I started thinking even then, and I used to do a lot of things, you know, I've always taught courses and stuff, and one day I said, like, you know, it occurred to me that, like, the only way to save the music, simply because the young musician now coming up doesn't have the strength, tenacity, or even willpower to resist the overtures of commercialism that are laid on you for you to survive. See, a guy, someone says, here, do a record. You're not ready to do a record, but you'd better do, and do it this way. Pick this guy so that you can get your music out there. And then destroy. Now, this is a black art. Well, the only way it could survive would be if the university and college in this country is going to survive, this should be a part of the curriculum. Now, what this was supposed to afford was an alternative. Then musicians, pardon me, who were interested in the art would have a place to work. Not just an artist in residence, because unless you get a hip artist in residence situation, it's just a filigree thing. It doesn't really do anything, you know. People watch you get drunk or something, you give a lecture, fall down there, because the larger places can afford to have you like that. But you make this person a real teacher, see, and you turn the person loose in what the person's doing. For example, it would be wrong to have had Duke Ellington as a Hadley fellow and ask him to discuss for a year 16th century counterpoint. You know, that might be fine for you to check out, like, what he knew about music in terms that you knew, but it wouldn't give you entree to how he did music and what made his music art. And that was the first thing that started me thinking about, like, how not only could we elevate the music, because true, you have a few nightclubs. Well, there are less nightclubs, and there will be less and less because of economics. No, a person would rather pay $5 for a record, $10 for a bottle of scotch, call his girl up, or if they're doing that, or smoking, whatever they do, and listen to the record, rather than going to a nightclub, spending $25, and under very bad circumstances, trying to hear some music. It's not like after the war, when people were into that gung-ho excitement thing, you know. I mean, after the war, it was incredible, man. That was how I learned to play. There were places all over you could go to, all kinds of music, and everyone was gung, people love music. People don't love it that much anymore. They don't want to go through the shit, and I don't blame them, but an art has to, that's the nature of art, man. Art is blood, sweat, and a whole lot of travail, that's what it is. And young musicians today need another kind of respite. You know, we had like, say, in the arts, we had Black Mountain College. The Germans realized it was the Bauhaus. Le Corbusier, when architecture was like a fragile thing in Europe, and those guys were talking about how could they really, I mean, it wasn't just like putting a building up for some rich person. There was an aesthetic behind it. They had to form a group. This guy, Soleri, this architect, has formed a group out, you know, out there in Arizona someplace. Frank Lloyd Wright, for various reasons, had to form his Taliesin, and that's what this music is about. It's very, very serious business. Of course, right now, it's only affecting a small group of people. But like the art of this music, don't forget, an artist does something, someone else hears it and can take it someplace else. And in this music, since it defies a certain kind of notation and can't be documented in a certain kind of way, there's open season on that kind of thing. So, ideally, this is the place. I mean, the university, which is supposed, don't forget, like, what is the university for? It certainly isn't to compete with, like, a General Motors in terms of making profits. It's supposed to be the place where you sequester people. For 4 years, they get certain things together. And you have, like, people you respect as teachers who are supposed to be able to deal in ideas, man. The whole thing about education bothers me now. Because we're not talking about ideas. We're talking about codified fact all the time. You know, codified fact and producing results that lend testimony to that fact. So that you find, like, a 17, 18-year-old kid is asking you, how can he be assured of making a living as a musician? And I don't know what that has to do. I don't know what that has to do with anything.
Are you talking about not being pleased with education in the way that it's practiced, or with the ideals behind it? The ideal being that this could be a place of exchanging ideas rather than facts.
I think it could be both. If I mean, I just don't think one. I don't think an art should be reduced. Fact. And I think if the nature, I've said this to a lot of people here and in other places, that like if the nature of an art changes, if an art changes the nature of its being dealt with as a study, the way teachers have got to handle it, that has got to change too. And all of those things can't be demonstrated as right at the time they're being done the same way. As an art is happening, we don't really know if it's right or what's going to be its durational value. We don't know. We don't really know. I think what has gotten me about so-called education is that, like, less people are interested in becoming educated. We deal with more things in education. We deal with, like, the stance you take in life, how you choose to address yourself to people. You can have, like, incredible information. And some unknowledgeable person will question the way you're dispensing the information, which, based on my traditional background, is completely unheard of. I don't even know how to do that. I mean, my generation, we had to shut up and listen. And then also, when you had enough information and then you could risk incurring the wrath of this other person, you could present an idea. And if you were sound in it, you were heard. Today, people are heard before they have an idea. They don't sit still long enough to get an idea. They don't know what learning, in a sense, that makes sense is, because they've been told that, like, everyone has something to say. Everyone is equal. You know there's no democracy. Everyone isn't equal. And what started out, I imagine, if education was like, you had a house on the hill and you put the scholars up there and you let them stay a while to get themselves together and then they could go back and do some things with these other people, which is the way I imagine we parcel off this thing about colleges and universities. It has failed someplace, man. Because people, even the idea, you hear such things as specialization now. Well, what the hell does specialization mean? I mean, what does it really mean? I mean, why should you deny a person? If a person says to you, look, man, I want to do this, if I believe him, I'm going to let him do it. That's his life. I can't protect that person. And I can't tell that person to take 39 million other things and become broad either, because I know what that's about. You know? So you find that money enters into it now, unfortunately. Money is, money seems to be the root of everything. Ideas don't seem to be in the arena of thought anymore. See, I mean, you advance an idea. Well, what if the idea has either got to produce something without people even paying it any attention, I had a kid once, you know, we were talking about black music, and this person said, a talented kid, because when I say talented, obviously had the ability to do something. And all of a sudden, the kid said, well, you're trying to change my aesthetic. I said, listen, let me tell you something. If you study Chinese philosophy, if you take a BA in it, or a master's and a PhD, does that make you Chinese? All it should really do is open your eyes up to other things, especially if you've spent that time. That's about all. So if you have a person taking a cello tutorial with you, it's not interesting that another person will say, well, do you play the cello? Which it so happens I do. I mean, but you know, they should be either in the room with you based on the fact that they think you have something, because if they don't, they shouldn't be in the room. There's not enough time for this kind of checking out. See, it's a waste of time. It's a waste of your time. It's a waste of their time. Although they may not construe it as a waste of their time.
But still, you find certain sanctuary in teaching. Teaching. Certain value in preserving and presenting your ideas.
Teaching, really. Now, for me, I don't know how many other people think of it that way, because, like, I think the teaching profession isn't really looked that highly upon. I think teaching is the highest form of creation there is. I think so, because, like, see, you're working. See, when you do music is something that you can only hear and not see, and you can't touch. If you paint, you can't hear a painting. You can only see it and touch it, you know. If you write, you can only see it, you can't touch the words, and you can't hear them. When you work with an individual, though, you are having an incredible amount of influence on the work they're going to do for the rest of their life. See. When you see good students, I have been extremely fortunate enough to have had students of mine who have just, like, taken whatever was and moved some other place. I've had some good goddamn students, and dedicated. And with me, I don't consider myself, I'm an artist who happens to teach, you see. So that's, you know, I'll tell you that right away first. I'm a musician and composer, and I consider myself an artist, and I happen to teach. At this point in time that I'm teaching, it's because the people who are around me understand what it is I do, and do my work on a very, very high level. So I'm not as hung up about teaching, per se, which probably makes me always appear to be rather vehement about things, you know, because it's a very, very serious business. But I think it's a very high form of art, and I think that's one of the things in America, certainly, that people have forgotten. They're now talking about certification, they're talking about graduate school, they're talking about PhDs, there's now a post-PhD that's going to happen. People are talking about tenure, they're talking about tracks, and they're talking about everything except doing their work and laying it on these people so that there's a continuum. You know, you leave. I would like to think that when I die, I've left something, man. I really would. I mean, not in terms of, like, things that people might be able to, like, you know, one time I said I was going to burn up all my music, and I think I will anyway, destroy all of it. But I think in the realm of, like, certainly being dedicated to the art and trying to make people see that, I think I do that very well.
What do you try to give to students when you're teaching? Is it a direction, or is it a body of knowledge? What exactly is it that you're...
Now, I would say it depends. See, when you teach in a liberal arts college, you have to remind yourself that that's where you are. Otherwise, you can go out. I mean, you know, by trying to make everyone do the same thing or be as intensely aware. I think the first thing I accept as an obligation is the presentation of a body of information. I think that would be number one. I think after I go through that, I think then I can sort of try to point alternative ways. See. I think that those would be the two things that I would do. The thing I think that is very disturbing sometimes to people is like when you insist that they do these things.
Are your expectations different for black students as opposed to white students who are studying with you?
Well, I really have never had that many black students who have studied with me. I would say, now to be perfectly honest with you, I would say that, like, I think the approach certainly differs. I could not...
Their approach to you or yours to them?
My approach to them, and I think their approach to me, too. I think white students approach me and work in a certain kind of way based on their historical tradition. And I think black students approach me and work in a certain kind of way based on the way they're viewing or their feelings about even having something as sacred as this part of their culture exposed to the wider horizons of the world. I've had to really think about that, you know? I mean, I've had to really think about it because you find that, I like to think that I treat people as individuals too, although sometimes you can block things in like that. But I really do, my expectation, I would say, of students or people around me, I have one expectation. What they do as much as it's been indicated to me that they can do. And sometimes they can indicate to me, and I think any person teaching someone would say this too. I think sometimes they can indicate to you in various subtle ways that they can do much more than what they think they can. See? There's a danger point because you can push a student too far. I have never done that. I've come pretty close, not here. And I came damn close. A guy studied with me 5 years. And he was pushed at that time just a bit too far. But I'll have you know though, a month ago in the mail, I hadn't heard from this man 3 years. A month ago in the mail, I got his first recording, which was dedicated to me. No note from him, because we don't speak anymore. But that is, one of these days I'll tell you that we'll have some time. It's an incredible story. Okay, but that's the only time that I've actually insisted in the way, and finally at the point the person's back went against the wall. But he caught on, and he continued. It's a pretty interesting record.
Is there a danger in exposing black music to the white culture, the danger to the black music itself, and that it could be, as we generally tend to do with everything, trivialized?
You know, I personally don't think so. But I know that, like, I would say this, 99% of black musicians will say yes, they will. In fact, I am probably the only teacher, black artist teacher, teaching right now, who doesn't hide a single thing about the process. I taught, one year I did a thing in composition, where I tried to teach the entire thought process as it occurred to me. And I know I have been very seriously taken to task by musicians for doing that. I was at a conference on Pan-Africanism, Queens College, this past weekend. And it was the arts in Pan-Africanism. It was a painter, myself, a museum curator. And I was it was brought out that, like, people, black people, are generally resentful of this attitude that I've taken. I say that, like, the reason I don't think there's a danger, is simply this. No matter what happens, once you do it or think it, it is in the air anyway. That's, can't hide anything anymore. The other thing is, people can only do what they're going to do anyway. And the other thing is, no one can do what you're doing like you can do. They can only do what you have shown them you've done in previous circumstances. Now, I had to get that out of my system, because in 1950, I didn't feel that way. No. I didn't dare show people certain things, because I felt that way. No, they'll take it, they'll make money off, they'll profit. And what the hell, if that's what they want to do, fine. But like, I'm not going to shortchange myself trying to be two people for them. It's too difficult, man, trying to remember who you are in white society and who you're supposed to be in black society. So I myself don't see that danger. Although a lot of musicians have. In Duke Ellington's music, there were never any piano parts, bass parts, drum parts, for some particular reason. A lot of that music is oral. A lot of it has nothing to do with the notes on the page, but how it's interpreted by these people, and how he's laid things on these people. A lot of Cecil's music, a lot of... Well, these people up here can tell you how my music is done. Very few other people who come in the room and understand the principles of it. And these people here have done pieces where they've used the elements and done some things the way all students will do, but that's perfectly all right. I don't feel out of danger at all. I think that's the nature. A teacher has got to expose himself and the thing he's teaching. That has been one of the problems with white history. White history has refused to be truthful. And they've shown those things, was shown them in a strong light. And we're all hurting today because of that.
Has the black music, as it's practiced here and in Europe, had any impact in Africa?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not?
Absolutely not. No. Well,
is there any
reason for that?
Yeah.
I would say the reasons are that the Africans are very caught up with rhythm in a certain kind of way. And we have been placing less and less emphasis on rhythm as a metric foundation, pulsative, moving in certain kinds of layers that way. Although there have been some incredible African musicians who have left Africa and who are performing in Europe. Some, are there any African musicians here? I don't know of any. I've met several. I worked with, in 1960, I was working with a white South African bassist, Midge Pike, who comes back and forth. He's become very famous now. Who was incredible. And he had come here because he wanted to work with black musicians. And I met a trumpet player. There's several trumpet players and saxophone players in both England and in Paris. Several players in Scandinavia who have a lot of guys from Trinidad, places like that, who have found it not at all difficult to extend themselves into this area, these areas of music. One of the reasons I think it hasn't affected Africa is that, like, the tours that have been set up both by the State Department and other groups of people have only included the popularized black music. That has been something that, so the Africans have not been intimately aware in contact. Because I'm going to tell you one thing, based on the way they're doing rhythm, it's only a matter of time before, I have two books that were sent to me on theory. I met two Africans in Amsterdam 2 years ago. And one fellow was from Nigeria. One wanted me, I really feel bad about that, one guy wanted me to sponsor him here, man. I only had to lay out about $500 and a lettuce and deposit that in the bank. He was doing PhD work, and I just didn't have the money. I had to let him in. And then that was his reason for coming here. He wanted to be closer in contact. I met him in the post office in Amsterdam when I was calling New York. But I think the reason for that has been, as I said, the exports of the music haven't been this music.
In the African music scene, is there a lot of things that we're familiar with, such as recordings of the work that's played on the radio and things written down, or is it less organized than ours?
Well, you know, I don't really know. I know WBAI had a guy, African, doing music with Africa. What dismayed me a great deal, the guy was very bright too, but I think that was the thing that got me too, because he should have known more, was that like there was a high emphasis, and this is what blacks and a lot of black critics are doing, they're making much too much out of indigenous popular forms. Which you could say for two reasons, man. You could say, well, this is one way they're assured of a readership and not alienating themselves to people, but they damn sure are not taking care of the business. And this guy's played a lot of what they call high life and things like that, you know, traditional African social dance forms. I mean, things like, you know, well, what the hell? I mean, we know about that. I mean, it's the same, we haven't been able to make the cleavage between what people are doing because that's what they do, and what they're doing because it has come, you know, what has come out of that, where someone has tried to extend it in another kind of way. Not saying that, like, African music, Africans don't believe in museums and things. Black people don't believe in museums per se as things, where I think they don't believe in the artifact thing in a way, although they do. I mean, things seem to have to be around and available, right? Although, if you have a traveling show of musicians or a traveling theater thing, that should really introduce people to these things so that they could really go into the habitat of those things and really see it. So if you have a group of dancers coming dancing in the street, that should encourage people to want to go to a dance concert. Or you have the jazzmobile guys playing out there, that should encourage people to want to go where the guys can really play. It doesn't seem to work that way for various things. Although the black exploitation films, Superfly and those things, have been able to get blacks into the theater. They don't expect those things to be shown in the street, which means to say there is an idea about what they should participate in and what they shouldn't participate in. But I think that the few programs where guys have played the music, there's been more of the thing on folklore, and most of the things done in folkloristic terms have been based on popular forms. Now there's a musician, Dollar Brand, whom I don't know too well, who is from South Africa. He's been doing a lot of things which supposedly are based on dances and things, children's games and things like that, or various things about when he was in South Africa. I've heard the music, man, and it doesn't, I don't know if you can do music on so small a premise, man. I think you've got to do the music, and then like after it's done, if that's what has happened, it's great. I was born on Nantucket Island. I can't write a piece of music about those beautiful beaches and stuff consciously. Or think about when I was a kid there, like, you know, and like we were the only family on the island, maybe 10 other families, and how desolate and beautiful. I can't write a piece of music defies that. I guess I could take a Nantucket folk scale or something and then set it to something, but what the fuck is that, you know? So I think what has happened, we don't really know. I haven't heard that many programs. And I used to listen to this guy in BAI because when I was going back and forth to New York, every now and then he would play something very, very interesting. But I got the feeling like he, like most critics, are involved in, they see a danger in going too far away from what they think are roots. A danger in losing their audience, losing this. And a lot of them really don't believe, like, the things that have been developed here are really, that's where you get the term, African-American or Afro-American. I will say all the time, I'm an American. I can't go through all this time. I was born here, see. I was born here, my parents were born here, they were, I'm an American. Obviously, I didn't come from China. So I don't have to have all of this stuff going, you know? Mm-hmm. But I would like to hope that, like, if we could get over the self-consciousness of it, see, I mean, you play the music, if you could play African music, and one of the dangers in places like Bennington and doing anything like that, if it's from another culture, people adopt it only exotically, man. Because there's less onus of any responsibility for them to take it seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like a little ballet, a little music, a little Balinese music, a little, it's always, you know, it's not really, a concentration. As far as I know, what we're doing here has had the longest thing in terms of concentration of anything that wouldn't have been ethnically, you know, involved with, like, say, white culture, per se.
The Black Music Division.
Yes. Yeah. And then, but you know what really tops you? But you have those white people playing it. That's unanswerable. What were you supposed to do? And what, 90 million blacks to play black music? Obviously, that's not the point that's being made. Black music here at Bennington is a course of study. Mm-hmm. That's, it isn't to turn everyone black.
I think you got enough on that.
You know, I mean...